This week on Making Contact.
Give North Koreans a reason to believe that something else will work.
North Korea is making headlines once again. The latest round of provocations and rise in tensions are renewing fears of another Korean War. But how and why did the conflict really start? And what role has the U.S. played over the years?
At the end of World War II, the Soviet Union and the United States agreed to divide Korea at the 30th parallel in order to accept the Japanese surrender. This was supposed to be a temporary division. No one expected this division to become long-term or permanent.
On this edition, we look at the Korean Peninsula, its history, geopolitics, and what it will take to bring permanent peace to the region. I'm Andrew Stelzer, and this is Making Contact, a program connecting people, vital ideas, and important information. While the end of World War II ushered in a new era of peace and prosperity in the United States, the Korean Peninsula soon became host to the Cold War. Most Americans know little about the history and politics that divided Korea into two states, and even less about life in the North. In a film produced in 2003, North Korea, Beyond the DMZ, Charles Armstrong, a history professor at Columbia University, and Jade Wu, the narrator of the film, shed some light on the division.
Korea has over 2,000 years of settled civilization. For most of that time, it's been surrounded by more powerful countries, and the Koreans have had to defend and to protect their cultural identity and their political independence very fiercely.
But in 1910, Japan took over Korea and for 35 years occupied the country. It was only at the end of World War II, when Japan was defeated, that Korea was liberated. Liberated for only 1 month.
At the end of World War II, the Soviet Union and the United States agreed to divide Korea at the 30th parallel in order to accept the Japanese surrender. This was supposed to be a temporary division which would lead to a unified government of the whole peninsula. No one expected this division to become long-term or permanent.
Anyway, this is no field day for Moscow or its sympathizers.
But the Cold War began, and America and the Soviet Union, once allies, were now enemies. Korea became the first battleground of the Cold War. The United States occupied South Korea, ushering a pro-American government into power, with Syngman Rhee as president. At the same time, the Soviet Union occupied North Korea and helped a pro-communist government claim control with Kim Il-sung as president. The Soviet troops withdrew by 1948, and the Americans by 1949, leaving a divided country with two very different and hostile governments. In 1950, the Korean War began. Both Koreas hoped to reunify the country by force. America rushed in with United Nations troops to support the South and to roll back communism. And then China joined in to help the North. The civil conflict became a bloody and devastating war. The fighting ended in 1953, but the war isn't over. There's no peace treaty, just a temporary armistice. The DMZ, or Demilitarized Zone, 2.5 miles wide, divides the peninsula, separating one side from the other. On one side are over 1 million North Korean troops. On the other, over 500,000 South Korean and 37,000 American soldiers who've been stationed in the South since 1954. There have been skirmishes and violent incidents, but for more than 50 years, the conflict has been mainly a war of fear and propaganda.
That was a clip from the 2003 film North Korea, Beyond the DMZ. North Korea has been referred to as the strangest country on Earth, and its leader, Kim Jong-il, as crazy. But how much do we really know about the country, its history, and most importantly, the experiences of the North Korean people? Up next, Making Contact's Kyungjin Lee shares the story of a survival of a brutal wartime massacre in 1950. A massacre that was carried out by U.S. and South Korean forces on North Korean civilians.
The official start of the war was June 25, 1950. The North Korean army reportedly opened fire and began advancing into the south. The porous border around that time allowed citizens and military personnel to cross the 30th parallel at will. But even before that day, skirmishes between the North and South were frequent, and many academics have questioned who actually initiated firing and when the war really began. While the Korean War is known as the Forgotten War in the U.S., most people who lived through it will never forget the suffering they endured. Wartime atrocities were committed by all parties, including American forces attacking North Korean civilians. 4 months into the war, American and South Korean troops began a campaign that killed more than 35,000 people in the county of Sincheon, North Korea. The massacre began on October 17, 1950, when Lieutenant William Harrison Jr., commander of the U.S. occupation troops in Sincheon County, gave the following order.
Any offenders shall be shot without exception. Arrest and kill all the Workers' Party members and the state servicemen, as well as their families and their sympathizers.
Over the next 2 months, thousands more were killed. On December 7, 1950, when American forces began their withdrawal from the region, Lieutenant Harrison gave another order to the troops under his command. Describing the withdrawal as temporary and for strategic reasons, he declared that all free civilians should go south with the Americans.
Whoever stays will be treated as an active enemy, and an atom bomb will be dropped on them.
Most significantly, he ordered all dependents of who he called Reds to be annihilated. Family members of soldiers in the North Korean People's Army and everyone working for the state was to be considered Red. His order was executed with devastating consequences. Chung Geum-sung was 6 years old when U.S. forces came to his hometown. He describes a raid on innocent victims by the invading troops.
여기 이 독의 창고에서는 미국 놈들이 도망치는 마지막.
In these two warehouses, 910 innocent civilians were imprisoned by the Americans. At one point, they took out all men and boys over 12 years of age and beat and stabbed them to death in the most horrifying massacre. So then only our mothers and us children were left in the warehouse. The Americans then used their rifles to stab and club at our mothers to take the children away from them and out of the warehouse. We were so scared and we tried desperately to hold on to the dresses of our mothers with all our strength to keep from being separated. But those bastards eventually dragged us out.
The children were then forcefully taken to a second artillery warehouse. There, the abuses continued.
Still, we were better off than the youngest children who were still of breastfeeding age. Seeing these children made us so desperate. We even tried to break open the steel bars, but we just couldn't get the door to open. As if our suffering wasn't enough, those damn Americans poured gasoline through the window. And since we were so hungry and thirsty, we thought that they were giving us something to drink. We used our rubber shoes to drink the gasoline and ended up getting so sick that our insides felt like they would explode. During that time, 60% of the children died of hunger and freezing. One day when we were all so weak that we couldn't even stand, the Americans opened the doors and poured gasoline all over us and put the entire place on fire. The whole warehouse became a sea of fire, and the children writhed in pain as they burned to death. Even now, when I enter this place, I feel like I can almost hear the desperate cries of the children who hopelessly called out for their mothers as they burned to death.
Through sheer luck, Jung survived the fire. He lay in the middle of the warehouse, protected by the scores of dead bodies that surrounded him, and was one of three children to live. In 1952, upon learning of this grave situation, the International Association of Democratic Lawyers sent a commission of 9 international delegates to North Korea to investigate claims of wartime atrocities. In their report, they describe instances of bacterial and chemical warfare perpetrated by the United States on North Korean military forces and the civilian population. They cite blatant violations of the Hague Convention, which regulates conduct for warfare, and the Geneva Convention, which prescribes the condition of treatment for prisoners of war. Atrocities such as these were not uncommon during the Korean War. The legacy of these unresolved war crimes still haunts today's society on both sides of the demilitarized zone. Today we see North Korea branded as part of the so-called Axis of Evil, while U.S. military forces still occupy South Korean soil, and 10 million families remain divided. It's been almost 60 years since the U.S. and North Korea agreed to a temporary armistice. But the two sides remain technically at war, which begs the question, what does a permanent solution look like?
...2010 brought two new conflicts to the Korean Peninsula, further deteriorating relationships between North Korea and the U.S. and South Korea. The North was blamed for sinking a South Korean submarine, the Cheon'an, which killed 46 sailors in March. The latest skirmish occurred in November, when North and South Korea exchanged artillery fire on a remote fishing island off the west coast. In the aftermath of the violence, two South Korean soldiers and two civilians were killed. President Obama dispatched a nuclear-powered aircraft carrier to the area, and the U.S. and South Korea continued their joint military exercises, further provoking the North. Making Contact's Hyunjin Lee spoke with two leading experts on Korea to talk about the current situation and what it means. Paul Lim is the president of the Korea Policy Institute. He joined us in our studio. And John Pfeffer is co-director of Foreign Policy and Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies and the author of several books and numerous articles, including North Korea, South Korea, U.S. Policy at a Time of Crisis. He joined us by phone from Washington, D.C.
Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us on the show.
Put the latest rise in tension and the history of North Korea's, quote, bad behavior into perspective. The North is always seen as the party that can't be trusted to keep its promises, and it goes against the grain of what the international community wants. Why does North Korea insist on taking this position, and why can't they play nice? Paul?
In terms of North Korea and the United States and our view of that country as being a country of bad behavior, I think that if we want this bad behavior, so-called, to go away, it's important for us to understand where it originates from. Every time, you know, there has been, from North Korea's point of view, backing away of engagement from the United States, what is their recourse for bringing the United States back to the table? Well, quite frankly, it is what the United States has historically responded to, which has been increased militarization in North Korea. That is not a desirable situation, but it reflects, I think, on our part, you know, a certain one-dimensional thinking towards North Korea. That is to say, we're happy with North Korea as long as North Korea stays above the 30th parallel and actually is not doing anything to, you know, rock that boat. We want to pursue non-proliferation. We don't want them to be threatening with nuclear weapons and so forth. And so we're only looking at North Korea as a potential military threat to be dealt with. We don't look at it as an historical entity that has some legitimate grievances in terms of the way it's been treated, and we don't address those. So from North Korea's point of view, they want to address those issues. They want a peace treaty, for example. But from our point of view, really all we have been concerned with is non-proliferation. You know, on the surface, it's a very reasonable thing to be concerned about nuclear weapons, but if it is one-dimensionally the basis of your understanding of the world around you, whether or not people are a threat to you or not, and you're not looking at to why they are a threat to you or not, that really, I think, hinders the situation. And I think that the reason why this so-called bad behavior occurs, you know, it is because historically it actually works from their point of view. I think what the Obama administration needs to do, and also Lee Myung-bak.
And Lee Myung-bak is the current South Korean president.
He's the current South Korean president. Is not give the North Koreans a reason, or actually give North Koreans a reason to believe that something else will work. So, for example, in the shelling of this island last November, I wish the North Koreans had not shelled that island. But then again, the North Koreans dumped 100 shells, you know, into the West Sea last August as a way of saying, don't do this. They have said on numerous occasions, don't do this. They said on the morning of the event, don't do this. What did South Korea do? And by the way, since the United States is still in military command as South Korean forces, the United States is very much responsible for that decision to go ahead and fire. They fired, and they fired without even evacuating the citizens, you know, civilians on that island. So, I mean, it's if we want these situations to stop occurring, if we want North Korea not to do these kinds of things, we have to give them a reason to believe that other things will work. And so far, that I don't think has happened.
How do you think the line that Obama is taking in association with Lee Myung-bak's administration, how do you think the turn of events that's happened in the last couple of years will affect the relationship between the two sides and the U.S. in the future?
Well, the Obama administration has basically adopted a strategy of strategic patience, what it calls strategic patience. In other words, you know, the Obama administration is distracted by an enormous number of foreign policy challenges throughout the world, as well as considerable domestic challenges here in the United States. And it has not wanted to invest very much political capital in trying to resolve the situation in the Koreas, especially since it has been challenged by conservatives in the United States for its promise or its pledge to reach out to authoritarian leaders or adversaries of the United States who are willing to negotiate. And as a result, the Obama administration has stepped back somewhat from that position, at least with respect to North Korea. So this policy of strategic patience has been very difficult to maintain, in part because although the Obama administration affects a certain patience, North Korea is not particularly patient at all. North Korea would like to see some kind of negotiations with the United States, would like to see a peace treaty with the United States, would like to see an economic deal so that it can revive its economy in some significant way. So this asymmetry between the positions of the Obama administration and North Korea, I would say it has produced a challenge in the region and a kind of an unsupportable and unstable situation. I think it's safe to say that that the Obama administration will not be able to maintain this kind of strategic patience, that it will be forced both by its critics in the United States, but also by the reality on the ground in Northeast Asia, to address North Korea in some fashion. The military option basically is not on the table, as the Pentagon itself has essentially said. which leaves the Obama administration with very few options. If it doesn't pursue its policy of patience, basically the only other option is engagement. And so then the question remains, well, when would this engagement take place, and what would it look like? But that, I suppose, is a different question.
We'll be right back. You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information or for CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. Because of listeners like you, this show is distributed for free to radio stations in the U.S., Canada, and South Africa. To find out how to support us, download shows, or get our podcasts, go to radioproject.org. We now return to an interview with Paul Lim, president of the Korea Policy Institute, and John Pfeffer, co-director of Foreign Policy and Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies, moderated by Making Contact's Hyunjin Lee.
So let's keep going with that. When would it take place, and what would it look like?
Well, I would say that at the moment, both the United States and South Korea are reluctant to, as they say, reward bad behavior. In other words, they have applied additional sanctions against North Korea, first as a result of its second nuclear test. South Korea, of course, has instituted more punitive policy, both when Lee Myung-bak took office, but also more sharply after the Chun-an incident last March, and then again after the Yeonpyeong incident. So it's not likely that engagement is going to take place immediately. However, my guess is that at some point in 2011, North Korea will pursue a somewhat more conciliatory positions, and it's just a question of when it becomes politically possible for leaders in South Korea and the United States to pursue some form of engagement with North Korea. So my guess is it'll take place sometime in 2011. The form it will take will, of course, be pretty tentative at first, because both sides believe that they've been burned by engagement approaches in the past. The United States believes that North Korea has been fundamentally treacherous in its approach on nuclear issues, and North Korea believes that the United States and South Korea have also not fulfilled their side of the bargain. So I think both sides are mistrustful of the other side. On the other hand, both sides see potential benefits, i.e., the United States and South Korea, but mostly the United States, is concerned about the nuclear issue. North Korea, of course, needs some injection of capital into its economy. So this will, I think, be the centerpiece of some form of package deal that the two sides will look at. But it will probably take a long time to negotiate anything of lasting value.
There are some folks in the U.S. who are waiting for the North Korean government to basically implode. Is there evidence that that government will collapse? And what's your response to people who are trying to be patient and waiting for that to happen?
One can never predict the future. But I think in the idea that North Korea is on the verge of collapse has been around for many, many years. I mean, for decades, there has been a sense that any time North Korea would collapse for one reason or another, but it has not. The latest concern about North Korea's stability is what will happen in terms of the transition of power if it goes to Kim Jong-il-son, which apparently he is, expected to become the next leader. There have been WikiLeaks indicating that, within 3 years the country will collapse and so forth. I think probably that's not going to happen. I think that You know, when I visited Pyongyang in 2005, you know, we didn't do a lot of extensive touring, but people were very tired. They were very weary, but they were still very engaged. I mean, the entire population, they still had rush hour. They were still going out in the fields, and people were really engaged and working. So, I mean, it did not have the appearance of being a society that is on the verge of collapse. I think that if we're premising our policy towards North Korea, or if the strategic idea behind strategic patience is let's be patient enough and, you know, eventually North Korea will implode, you know, I think that that's really ill-advised.
What is the ultimate solution to this very long situation? Is it even in the U.S. interest to see peace in Korea? And what do you think will make all the parties, including North Korea, South Korea, and the U.S. happy?
Well, I would say it is definitely within U.S. national interest to see peace and reunification on the Korean Peninsula. Basically, the current situation is highly unstable, and it's also unpredictable, and the United States certainly does not need another nuclear power. It does not need a situation that could flare up into a major military conflict that it could be drawn into. It does not need its economic interests in the region to be threatened by significant military instability. From this point of view, the United States and China, for instance, have very similar perspectives. In terms of a long-term solution, well, North Korea is not likely to go anywhere anytime soon in terms of regime collapse. More likely than the collapse scenario is some kind of reform scenario in which North Korea pursues some variant of the Chinese model. Now, of course, North Korea would never say that it was pursuing the Chinese model. It would say it was pursuing its own version of change, and that form of change would probably be an opening up economically at the same time of preserving the political position of the Workers' Party in the country, similar to what the Chinese have done since 1979. The question really is whether the United States, South Korea, and Japan will encourage that kind of transformation or will basically attempt to retard it. In other words, if the United States, South Korea, or Japan believes that the regime is going to collapse at some point, then they're not going to extend the kind of economic assistance to North Korea that would be required for any kind of change to take place within the country. It's only when the United States, South Korea, and Japan finally realize that that they actually have to engage the country significantly with significant economic assistance for it to pursue that kind of a transformation that such a transformation will take place.
I want to thank you both for joining us this evening, Paul Lim and John Pfeffert. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's it for this edition of Making Contact. Special thanks to Third World Newsreel for providing a copy of North Korea Beyond the DMZ. For a CD copy of this program, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736. Or check out our website at radioproject.org to get podcasts, download past shows, or help make a difference by supporting our work.